Hi, it's August 19th, 2010. I'm David Druin, and this is 508, a show about Worcester.
I'm Mike Benedetti. Also on the show today, we have...
Melissa Smith.
Kyle Mahoda.
Bill Sontag.
Tim Lowe.
Paul Cuttenwar.
And aging hipster, Brendan Malikin.
How are you?
Good. Victor Infante of the Telegraphic Gazette called you a hipster this
you
week.
That hasn't happened in like 10 years, but I guess it's kind of flattering now. I'm approaching middle age, so that feels nice.
There you go. At least you're hip. Well, anyway, we'll get back to that later in the show. First, where are we today? We're at Becker College, ladies and gentlemen. It's home of the perfect game, right?
That's true. Yes.
Home of the perfect game and home of the fourth ranked video game design program in the United States.
And first in New England.
And Paul, you're the chair of the...
Chair of the design department.
The design
that
department.
Includes not only these game folks, but also graphic design and interior design.
So tell me, what goes into teaching people video game design?
Actually, it's a ton of stuff.
Okay.
We start out with a basic program in art education or in computer science, depending upon which track students want to take, whether they want to be programmers or artists.
Okay.
Then from there, we take them into applying those art skills or those computer skills to actually developing video games.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, they also pick up a lot of liberal arts, history, English, math, science. And we give them the flexibility. So if they started out in art, want to switch to computer programming, that's fine. If they started out in programming and wanted to switch to art, that's fine. If they want to do both, they can do that too.
And video games are one of these things kind of like grand opera or the movies, that there's a lot of trades involved in making a game, yeah?
Absolutely. Writing is very, very important. The art side is very important. But if you have a great story and you have the art, if you have the eye candy, the game is not going to sell unless it's fun to play. Mm-hmm. So you got to have those three elements. It's got to be fun to play, it's got to have a great story, and it's got to look really good.
Is it possible to teach somebody to make something fun? Is this a well-understood problem? Adding fun to things or creating fun things?
You know, I don't know how well understood it is, but it certainly is possible.
Okay.
And I think it's kind of a visceral feel kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you pick it up as you go.
You make enough things, and at some point you're like, I know how to make good and bad things. I'll make good things.
There's some analysis involved, too. But, yeah, pretty much it's a trial and error. That's why one of the most important parts of any game company is the quality assurance piece.
Mm-hmm.
They call it play testing. You create the game and then you play the test. You play test the heck out of it.
And then you ask people and you say, you know,
is this a good game?
Are you going to go home now or are you going to play this game all night?
Exactly. And if they play it all night, then you got a good game.
Well, whenever I told people I was coming here, the one question they wanted to ask is how do you guys compare against WPI? How do you guys compare against MIT? Here's the top eight according to Princeton Review video game design programs in the U.S. Number eight, MIT. Number seven, WPI. Number six, Art Institute of Vancouver. Number five, RPI. Number four, Becker.
Yay!
Number three, Drexel. Number two, DigiPen, which is a program in Redmond, Washington. And number one, USC. So there's two in this neighborhood. How is it that in this neighborhood of Worcester, there's two of the top-ranked video game programs?
I think it's something in the water. But no, actually, and it was
lack of fluoride in the water.
Yes, lack of fluoride, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a key to the success.
Yeah, I think it was Kurt Schilling who actually said that first. I stole it from him. But I think if you look at those eight schools that made the top list, they all have some certain things in common.
Okay.
We all do things a little bit differently, but we all have dedicated programs in game design. It's not like you go in and take an art major and take a few courses in game design. Or you go in and you take a degree in computer science and you take a few courses in game development. We have the actual degree programs.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that in all those top schools. We have flexibility in the curriculum. If you want to switch back and forth, you can do that. We have a strong liberal arts basis. So you learn the science and the math and the history and the writing. So all that is very important. I think all that are hallmarks of these top programs. But more so here at Becker, I'd have to say. And I think that speaks to why we were rated so highly in the Princeton Review.
And how long has the program been going on?
5 years. We had our first real graduating class this last May.
How are those guys doing?
Well, they could tell you.
Are you guys graduated?
Yeah. We graduated this May 2006.
Do you have a job?
No. All right. Now, unfortunately.
It's a hard economy.
It is. There are a lot of jobs, not just in game, from what I've done with my job searching, there's a lot of jobs, not just in game design in the industry for gaming, but also graphic design and advertising. Just right now with the economy, a lot of companies aren't willing to take the chance of hiring someone new who possibly may or may not actually know what they say they know on the resume, and are actually looking for people who have 3 or more years of industry experience instead.
So you got to get that. Are people doing, do you guys know people who are doing internships or any of those kinds of things available, or what are people doing in lieu of employment?
I am still searching for a job as well. I haven't really seen anything about interviews, but as he says, everybody is really looking for experienced workers, and it's kind of hard breaking into not just like the well, he's a design, so he's got
everything else. Yeah, I'm design. Kyle was in programming. We're actually both roommates for 3 years as well.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to get anything to deal with production, printing, graphic design, sales, and it's still everything across the board is looking, generally looking for 3 years plus of experience.
Yeah.
Though some of our peers, and one of them being our friend Matt Sylvia, has actually started his own company called Nukefile. And he and our friend Justin Carvalho are both working on developing game for the iPhone and the iPad.
Yeah. I always read that, I don't have an iPhone, but I always read that this is like where people are focused. There's a lot of game energy focused on that.
Yeah, because as long as you have the know-how, it's fairly simple to really develop for these things. We had a special topics course where we learned, you know, developing for the iPhone. And at least from a design standpoint, developing for the iPhone and iPad is a generally simple thing. It's not really all that complex to try and implement what's to be used for, you know, art assets.
Brendan Malikin, do you have any questions for
me? I do. Actually, back for you guys. Where do you folks see yourself fitting into the sort of cart and horse argument? Like, if you have a program here, is there potential for this to, say, seed, like, industry here in Worcester? You know, is there been any calls put out to, like, see if there are companies, knowing that we've got two programs right in the same neighborhood, calls to, like, companies coming into Worcester, knowing that there's now going to be a growth in the bodies and brains capable of doing the work locally?
We're definitely creating a critical mass, and what we have to offer any company that wants to settle here is the fact that we have the human capital.
Yeah.
We have these brilliant young minds that are ready to go to work. And that's a big step forward. That's the basis for a cluster initiative that we're actually putting together around making this the geographic area where, if you're in game design, this is where your company will succeed because of these kind of assets.
Just to give you some context, Massachusetts is the fourth largest game design cluster in the country right now, about 76 companies, 1,200 employees across the state, $2 billion industry here. Yeah. So it's a big business already. It's sort of a mainstream business. You may not know it, but it is. We're trying to sort of elevate it and attract or focus more attention on it as a sort of distinct entity within the broader sort of creative economy, digital design world. I mean, this games intersect all over the place. They intersect in education, they intersect in training, they intersect in the military, and there are game development opportunities that aren't simply entertainment. So it's much broader. Entertainment's big business. I mean, it's projected to be, I think, about $90 billion globally on the game side, which is triple the size of the music industry, and I think far surpassing the movie industry as well.
Right.
So this is a hefty opportunity, not only for our students here, and but the Commonwealth in general. And, you know, hey, we're on the cutting edge here in Worcester. We've got two of the top programs, so we're trying to leverage that as much as we can.
That would be pretty incredible if the whole Elm Park neighborhood just had, like, every other house, it's like some kind of video game shop.
Is that industry, speaking just of the Commonwealth, is that industry traditionally more heavily weighted towards inside 128, or is it pretty evenly distributed throughout the Commonwealth?
It's more in Eastern Mass. I mean, Cambridge is the epicenter.
Newton Watertown.
But
there's a lot of, game development companies and similar companies.
We're going to take it back, though, because now we have two of the top video game programs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Forget about it, Boston.
We're working towards an event, actually, later in October, where we're going to try to concentrate some forces and sort of make a big statement that, hey, Worcester has
That's kind of why I was asking. I mean, if you go out to, and I've seen this myself through personal experience, you go into any office that is in the tech sector out in Metro West, and you're likely to find rooms full of people from Worcester, or at least that went to school in Worcester. The jobs are there, but the education seems to be here. And it's just a matter of getting people to realize that, you know, those jobs can actually be here where the students are. But
yeah, we're going to try to sort of help foster a landscape that is an attractive place for people not only to start their companies, but keep them here, or even maybe even attract companies from other states. I mean, it's
yeah, I mean, that's why Omen Initiatives, I think, it created a pretty good framework to show that that kind of model does work and then marries up quite well with the education sector.
Yeah, I mean, this clusters with the academic piece, obviously, then you have the private sector piece and the public sector piece.
Right.
If we all work together, biotech is one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, telecommunications, green economy, green sort of sector is coming together nicely. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a... we fit right in there. As I said, this intersects across all these, particularly with healthcare too. There are a lot of applications related to healthcare. There's the gamification of a lot of things going on.
But ultimately, these men and women are artists, and that seems to be what the city's always screaming for, is more creative capital in the city. So retaining them is a win across the board.
It's definitely the creative economy. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking for in this region, what we hope to start, actually in October to put together, is a perfect storm with the three components, the public sector, the private sector, the academic sector. When those three come together, then what you hope is that you've created a situation where the creative potential and the competitive advantage for the companies to locate here is so great they can't locate anywhere else.
Here you go. I want to ask you guys a question that doesn't have to do with economic development. Whenever you guys are making games, I mean, I assume that you guys are all interested in games because you've played video games and you've enjoyed playing video games. Like, what do you see out there today or through the history of games as being like the games that are, I don't know, like your Citizen Kane, or like the game that you look at and say, this is a game that I want to make? Like, it doesn't have to be like the grand whatever game of all time. Just like, what are the games that when I say to you, what are the best games, you're like, this?
I'd say I'm personally a big fan of the Legend of Zelda games. From the original, even up to Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, and Twilight Princess, and that. It's a franchise that's been able to move through all the ages and the different consoles and that.
It's one of those Mario type things.
Yeah, it's like Mario in that there's always a new game coming out every year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always working on it and towards some new innovation in the gameplay.
Top games. A lot of what Square Enix has done in the past, I personally have not been very impressed with a lot of their newer games, like Final Fantasy 13.
Okay.
But their older games like Chrono Cross and Chrono Trigger, Super Mario RPG, Nintendo's Super Mario 64, GoldenEye 007 for the N64, the God of War series for the PS2 and the PS3, just because of their game mechanics, the things to unlock and find, the ability to explore and find new stuff, and the replayability, to always go back to the game and find new things. And the company Atlus for their Persona series, for how they so well integrate dungeon crawling and grinding and exploration with character development and unlocking, finding new things within your party members that actually links back to how well you can perform in combat systems.
Dungeon crawling.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Forget the bar.
The iconic games for me would probably be like starting with like Doom, just like the idea of like the first person shooter that, and like Castlevania. I've always been action oriented, and like going from that to like a Counter-Strike with adding the multiplayer aspect of it, I'm just adding the social aspect of gaming. It's huge now. Now with the all the MMOs, you have millions of people congregating, and
that's kind of an amazing. Awesome. That's kind of an amazing phenomenon.
Yeah.
Stuff like would that be like stuff like Warcraft?
Yeah. The World of Warcraft. Millions and millions of people worldwide playing it all at the same time.
Yeah, I used to play World of Warcraft for a few years, and I would play with people in like Wisconsin, Texas, Brazil, France, and like the server is set to its own time, and people just find their own time to log on and play together and do things, and there's a whole social aspect with it. And with Warcraft being so successful, MMOs really taking off, and you get bigger other series coming with big titles like Guild Wars 2 coming out, Warhammer, 40K, Dark Millennium. Mm-hmm. It just becomes such a huge thing because it's so easy to connect and communicate with people you know and meet new people worldwide.
Mm. I'm going to echo what they said. Probably my favorite game right now is World of Warcraft, just enjoying the whole social aspect of, you know, people coming from different backgrounds, you know, different stories, mm-hmm. you know, all forming together in sort of a group or a guild, working towards, you know, goals and overcoming them, while, you know, introducing you to people you would never meet, you know, just working around, you know, in like one central area, just getting to know all these different people and sharing that experience, you know, overcoming a goal, things like that.
Yeah.
Castle Wolfenstein.
Oh, so, old school.
Yeah, that's old school.
Take it back.
You can play it on a sort of emulator.
Call of Duty is actually my favorite game. There's a realistic aspect to it that's really neat. It's also, no one wants to be, you know, in a war situation, but at least it gives you, one of the neat things about games is that it puts you in a situation where you may not ever want to be in real life, mm-hmm. but it gives you an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, being sort of different, immersive environment almost.
Exactly.
Do you have a...
You're really going to ask me? I would actually fall on the side of early first-person shooters. I still won't buy a computer or a smartphone that can't play Doom.
I remember when I first discovered Doom. I just played Doom for like I think literally 4 days straight. It took me to beat Doom.
Then I was kind of
scared and didn't play it
anymore. One of the first ports for Android. When Android first started rolling out, a port was available almost overnight. It was barely functional, but it was still beautiful. It was perfect. Yeah. And it was the exact same game we played however many years ago.
Well, I want to geek out on something much less exciting for a little bit, and then we'll come back to video game stuff and talk about something that we've talked about over and over on the show, the Telegram and Gazette website. So the Telegram and Gazette paper in Worcester this week has started charging for local news stories. Previously, you could get the past 2 weeks of all the paper free online. And now they will give you 10 local news stories per month free online, which is, some. And if you want more than that, you either need to be a print subscriber or pay a $15 monthly fee or a $1 daily fee. And I think it's, we've talked about the Telegram Gazette a lot on this show. We've talked about stuff about their website, like a humongous amount on this show. And I think I don't know that the website details are important. I think the Telegram Gazette's important because local paper is really important. I mean, it's letting people know what's going on and sort of watching business and watching government and, helping people have a sense of continuity and sort of writing history as it goes along. If you want to know what was going on 5 years ago in the city, like an old copy of the TNG is a really good way to find that out. So I think it's important to sort of see what's going on with our local newspaper. And it's sort of kind of an undercovered story also. I don't think they like to write about themselves. Maybe they feel weird about that. So this week they started charging for it. I guess that there's probably a technical aspect to this and like a media ecology aspect to this.
All I know is that people are not happy with us talking about it, it seems.
People are not happy with us talking about this. Actually, some people are. I've gotten a ton. There's a lot of people who really, really hate the Telegram and Gazette. Like, I'm not in that category. Like, I get frustrated by some things they do, but I think it's, like, important to have this newspaper. And they're certainly, they're not, like, the worst newspaper in the world by any means. There's people who hate them. Like, I've been getting a lot of emails and comments this week from people who are, like, just... somehow them putting up the paywall just proves that this person's hatred for the Telegram and Gazette is justified or in some weird way. But some people have been angry at us talking about this stuff. I want to talk about the technical aspects of it just because we don't really know the financial and traffic aspects of this in any detail, whereas we know the technical aspect. It's a really basic paywall. It's just like a cookie-based thing. So I think that actually some small portion of the readership is going to sort of be inadvertently avoiding this paywall.
Right.
Like anybody who's got their web browser set up so that when it closes, it like resets. Like maybe them and their wife use the same browser and don't want to like accidentally get on each other's email accounts. Like that will just take out the cookies and the Telegram and Gazette website will think you're a brand new person and you could just be reading free articles every day if you're without even knowing that you're getting around it. Or if you set up some kind of cookie blocking or... Mm-hmm. In some other way.
But those technical issues are important because if they want the experiment to provide anything, right, it would be meaningful data. And you can't get that meaningful data unless you've made sure that you've covered all your bases in terms of the technical aspects of the site actually functioning properly.
Well, I see. So let me.
Here's a good example.
Okay.
Like if you were to block those cookies, then their analytics are going to show that you Mike Benedetti, every time that you just traverse the site, you're now being registered as a unique user because they're relying upon those cookies to actually track your movement. So unless they're getting more granular and looking just at IP addresses, which I don't think they're actually doing, they're going to see a heavy amount of traffic that isn't actual traffic, or it's not new traffic. They're viewing something as being unique when it's actually
visitors. Well, that's kind of unavoidable. I mean, you know, people have been emailing me like, oh, you know, you can get around it by going through Tor or some kind of proxy. It's like, surprise, surprise, you can get around things by doing arcane stuff. I mean, I've been trying to figure out an accurate number for how many people actually do something weird with their cookies.
It's
nobody,
a small number, but again, the data, that whatever they end up with, even if they decide that the experiment's a complete failure, it still is a success in the sense that they're able to collect some data and show, here's why it was a failure. Maybe we can do something better down the line, you know, change the model a little bit, but until they tighten up all of those holes, the data doesn't really exist. It ends up being meaningless. Well,
I actually bring up the technical details because I want to say that I like the general way that they've done this website. I like the fact that it's set up so that when the paywall breaks, it's like the gate is open, not the gate is locked shut. You know, it's not like this is not the Fort Knox of websites, and I think that that's fine. I mean, there's probably some.
It's a very user-friendly castle wall.
It's very user-friendly because it's like when it breaks in favor of like the random person.
Right.
So if you have some weird thing going on with the cookies or some weird configuration on your computer, you're going to be like blithely, you know, getting these free articles. But the nice thing is that it's not like set up so that if you have some weird configuration, it blocks you. And there's probably executives at the New York Times Company who are like, you need to lock this down as tight as possible. But I think the flip side of that is that if you're trying to catch that like last 1% of people who are doing, you know, because they're security conscious or whatever, are doing weird things with their computer, like you're just going to inconvenience the 99%. You're going to get all these customer service calls. You know, if everything has to work perfectly for the web, for the thing to work, it's not going to work perfectly all the time. And you're going to have all these people fielding phone calls all the day so somebody can read Diane Williams. And you don't want to do that. You just want like people to pay money and, you know, if people are going to... Anyway, I think that's a really healthy attitude. I know that you've been like emailing them and trying to get them to fix things.
Just trying to be helpful. Again, I mean, like you said, I mean, I think it's easy for people to say like we point out things that appear to outsiders as flaws with the paper, and it's not to like be mean or pick on the writers or pick on the institution. It's because, at least for myself, I think of myself as a pretty big like media fanboy around here, right? I mean, like, I really appreciate that paper and what it does, and part of that is making sure that it exists, right? Which, you know, if they're down to this point where they think a paywall is the best way to raise revenue, it should call into question, you know, the economic healthiness of the overall institution. So you get to take this stuff seriously. So yeah, I mean, some of these holes that we've been able to find and other people have found have been emailing off to the team there, and they all seem very appreciative of all of these issues that have been coming up, because it's a learning curve for them as well too.
Yeah. So one of the Boston papers or one of the Boston radio stations was covering the story, and they said that they had the TNG had thousands of registrations on the first day. It wasn't clear to me exactly what these were, how many of them were like $1, $15, if maybe people who were previously print subscribers were being counted in this number either. I don't know, but best case scenario, that means hundreds of thousands of dollars a year of revenue like that. You know, hey.
And if it works, that's great. I mean, there's been other experiments like this have taken place elsewhere. This isn't a new concept, and it's been mostly an abject failure everywhere it's tried. We've seen upwards of 75% decrease in traffic online. Doesn't necessarily affect anything on the print side, but in terms of the revenue side online, it usually takes a big hit. Right. Maybe that experiment will prove different in Worcester. Who knows? This is a city where it's tough to get people to pay a buck to park. So I'm not totally sold on the idea that $15 for a monthly website subscription is going
to
fly.
Well, I have to mention one other thing. So, you know, for years now, I've been like occasionally, periodically going on the TNG and saying like, how much hard news is there? How many really good features are there in today's paper? And then how much hard news is there coming from like informal sources, whether it's nonprofits or businesses or bloggers or whoever? And the Telegram and Gazette does better than all the informal sources put together almost every day. And I haven't really noticed the informal sources catching up to the Telegram and Gazette. I don't want the informal sources to take over the Telegram and Gazette, but as the paper cuts staff, it would be nice to see like the plain people of Worcester step up, but they're not stepping up. But so one question that came to mind when this happened is like, is 10 free articles a month enough to stay civically engaged? So I did something I've been meaning to do for a really long time, which is I made one of those websites with a long name and a short website, which is, I think it was, is there anything good in today's TNG.com? And if you go to there, it will say yes or no. And that word will link to either a form where you can type in the good article that I missed so I can put that on there. Or if it's yes, it will link to like the article that it's like, if you only have 10 articles you're going to read this month, this is one of the articles to read. And so, some like I said, I got a lot of positive feedback, and people were like, ha ha ha, this is great, or whatever. And Victor Infante of the TNG, who has in the past been a fan of this show, but maybe no longer, was the interesting thing is he was actually writing like these lists of like, here are like the articles that I consider the best articles today, which I think is actually pretty gutsy for a newspaper reporter to be like, I'm going to just like say which of my colleagues' work is good and by implication.
Yeah, but it's also, but at the same time, it kind of misses the point entirely, because that's the view of the quality of work from someone who works as an editor inside the institution. I mean, I think better reflection of how the paper is doing is how people, average people on the street, feel about the quality of journalism. Mm-hmm. And I think most people would agree that the quality is, for the most part, good. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's worth paying for every day. Well, which is kind of the entire point.
You know,
and I think that, well, you know, it might be a nice segue back to video games, right? But I mean, I think you guys probably all know that there are plenty of models out there where, like you say, in game design, where you aren't necessarily handing somebody cash for a DVD or whatever, old school cartridge, right? You know, just online, you're looking at like flash-based systems and whatnot that are mostly ad revenue supported. There are lots of models out there where attention is actually the capital in play, and then you find a way to monetize that attention after the fact, right? And that seems to be the one thing that in all media sectors, traditional journalism has failed to actually move in that direction, where they don't realize that the attention of their user is actually the most valuable thing they can possibly get their hands on. And then from there, the trick is finding a way to capitalize on it.
Well, if we had 4 minutes left in the show and you had one question to ask, what would the question be for these guys?
Have any of you bought a subscription to the Telegram online yet?
I want to ask this. I want to ask the student type people, and we occasionally do shows where we have like students or recent graduates, and so we ask them these questions so that they can be the voice of their generation or whatever. Like, when you guys have been students, did you guys read the paper in Worcester online in print?
Well, the school is kind enough to provide us papers down at the cafeteria, and yeah. I'd read that usually.
We would
3-4 times a week.
Well, about like 12 or 13 of us sitting around a table at dinner, just looking at different articles and talking about things that interest us and looking at together.
Yeah. So you guys are aware that there's a paper and all that.
Yep.
Okay. But none of you guys are, and probably, do you think these guys get free access through Becker to online?
I don't know. We certainly have it in the any of the periodical databases, but there might be a day delay on those.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But
they get the
for
students,
research purposes.
Yeah, the students get paper copies every day.
Yeah, where there's a service that provides, college newspaper services that you might have. I think we have USA Today, the Boston Globe, and the Telegram available, and all that.
So this paywall has nothing to do with these guys.
And sticking in the with the theme, I think Worcester Magazine had up as their poll question this week. Are people ready, or Worcester residents ready for college students to come back to town? When do classes actually start?
Be back on the 30th of August.
30th. Okay.
That's when classes start.
Some are probably coming back now.
So that's immediately thereafter.
Athletics has started to begin on campuses. So
it'll be immediately thereafter that we start. Well, there'll be stories that we can't access in the Telegram describing how all the college neighborhoods are then, on fire and wheels falling off the bus riots.
That doesn't happen around here. I mean, there may be other parts of town.
Mardi Gras.
Right.
But
Well, guys, thanks for coming back early and talking to us today. Thanks for being on the show. I want to ask you, is this guy supposed to be dressed up like the guy in Legend of Zelda?
That seems to be one of our students.
What?
Yeah, that's Matt Sylvia.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He graduated with these guys last May.
Yeah, one of our late professors, Teresa Alm, took Matt, a picture of Matt, and the man assigned her, and made a kind of fantasy setup for each of them. Matt is supposed to be a rogue, I guess, and Amanda was set up to be a mage.
Awesome. You can tell I don't know anything about video games. thanks for being on the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for watching. We'll talk to you next